Hi, my name's Ali, and this is the Russ Files Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As regular listeners will know, I'm always joined by a guest, and this time I'm actually joined by two guests. So, hi Smith and hi Lily.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good.
There's two of us.
We're doing quite well.
Excellent. We're actually doing like a three time zone special here today, so...
Get your three time zone special! Sorry.
Yeah, so Lily is joining me from...
From St. Petersburg.
And Smith is joining me from...
Brooklyn, New York.
Awesome, and I am in Milton Keynes, which is a place in the UK. As you probably deduced from my accent, but just because that's your accent doesn't necessarily mean that's where you are. I don't know why I... or as... Sorry, quality podcasting there. Massive life insight. You don't have to stay in the place where your accent
that's
is from.
Hilarious. Okay.
Right. So before I derail this process any further, could you folks tell us a little bit about yourselves? So, Smith, do you mind going first?
Sure. My name is Smith Freeman. In terms of relevancy to this podcast, I'm the co-host of She's in Russia along with Lily. And it's a podcast that kind of came out of our response to the American representation of Russia in mainstream media and wanting to just like give a more nuanced image of Russia. So we talk about a lot of different stuff, history, politics, current events, music, pretty much anything that's Russia related is potentially a topic. And I live in Brooklyn.
Awesome. And over to you, Lily, for you are the she of the title.
It's true. I'm she. yeah.
Except when it's they, but we can get into that in a minute.
Right. So, yeah, Smith, you just introduced the podcast. Smith is the podcast, and I am the she, and I'm basically...
Division of labor. Planned economy.
That's how it goes. Yeah. I'm trying to think what is the best version of myself to present, but basically I live in St. Petersburg. I've lived here for a little over 4 years now. I just had my like 4 year mark, and I am a former student of Russian literature and a current co-host of She's in Russia.
Awesome. So yeah, how did you, Lily, decide that Russia was going to be a place that you wanted to go?
Yes. How did I decide that it was? Well,
people always ask me this, and I'm kind of like, eh, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, people do always ask me this too, and I'm really working on thinking of a better way to answer it that will be most entertaining. And so far, it's been hard. But like the actual reason I came, so there's the reason, the sort of technical reason is I came as a student just to basically improve my Russian. I was studying Russian in college. And just to be able to be like, to give context to studying Russian literature with an actual experience of everyday life. And I was interested particularly in St. Petersburg because it is a attractive city in a lot of ways. And then I came to study. And then I feel like the reason I've sort of gone back and tried to make a narrative about the reason why I ended up living here and ended up staying.
Yeah, because it's one thing saying how you ended up going, but you're still there after 4 years, and that's more than just, you know, well, it was a fun way to pass, you know, 12, 18 months, whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did go, I've actually technically been here for more than 4 years because I did come back to the States, and then I, like, made the decision to move 4 years ago, mainly with this feeling of, like, not having gotten enough of it, basically. I was just like, I didn't want to have a temporary experience or an experience that was necessarily temporary the way a study abroad program is, where you know.
Yeah, it's kind of very neatly bracketed of like,
right,
I'm going for this time and I've reached the end of that time period. So
right, and it's just
go.
Like whatever, like, especially language wise, I felt like I had really, at the time I was like, I could still barely speak Russian after the study abroad program. So I was like, well, that is probably isn't satisfactory.
I want to get my money's worth.
So, I mean, that was a big thing. And then I just really particularly loved St. Petersburg for a lot of reasons. It's kind of like, I don't know, I'm still trying to figure out what it is that I love about the city, but it's definitely like particular to this place, you know. I haven't had the desire to live in...
It's not Russia as a whole.
Right, right. Or like, I mean, I'm interested in seeing Russia as a whole and visiting places, but even sure. Like Moscow doesn't draw me in as a place to live. So it's been...
As a former Muscovite, I'm deeply offended, but go on.
The ongoing rivalry is still strong, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, did you choose to go to Moscow after being in St. Petersburg, or did you first go there and then, like...
No, I just went to Moscow because that's where the job was, and then I just kind of stuck there because that's where my friendships were, and then that's where my... now wife lived. So and she did a very similar thing to you. She studied Russian language and literature at uni, did a year abroad as part of her degree, and then went back. I mean, she graduated not that long after the financial crisis, so it was kind of like, there are no jobs, so hey, I can teach English and improve my Russian at the same time. So
totally.
That was kind of how she ended up being back there. It was, yeah, I think that was, the crisis was a big part of that.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, so Smith, you've been to Russia a few times now, and at the time of recording, you've just got back.
Yeah.
How many times have you been there now?
Just twice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I went the same time last year and stayed for like, I guess about 2 weeks. And
gotcha.
Then... this year for 2 weeks also, and then we were traveling around in Greece, so like out of the country for about a month. But
okay.
Yeah, just
you
twice
could count...
now. But I think that...
Sorry, I was gonna, you could count 4 times because both times you came back for 1 day in Moscow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I've been to Moscow now for like a total of like maybe 40 hours, and I've only seen outside of the train stations. The older part of Moscow I've seen.
Gotcha. Okay. So I was going to say, like, I was going to ask that classic question in Russian, which is, or translated back into English, which is, what were your impressions? But probably not, like, that spectacular.
Yeah, no, I really haven't. It's kind of unfortunate because both times I've been in Moscow, we've, like, gotten in kind of late, so it's been dark, and then usually the next day I get on a plane. So I really don't have a good... perception of Moscow except for what Lily has told me.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a ton to say about St. Petersburg. I was there for maybe similarly, like, I think I went for about 2 or 3 days. I think it was 3 days back in 2010, which is nearly a decade ago now. That's gone scarily fast. But it was not that long after, you know, really the peak of White Nights. It was early July, and so it was, I kind of experienced that magical, you know, it's dark for like an hour. But yeah, Lily, I'm going to talk all about my experience in St. Petersburg, and I was there once. What is it like, because you say it's like a special place to live, but what is it that you enjoy about it?
Yeah, I mean, like right now, I just got back also from a trip, and I'm like having... I mean, I'm feeling really good about the city just because it's, like, nice to be home, kind of. And I have, like, a, you know, it's nice to not be traveling after a long period of traveling. But it's, like, also raining and it's been gray all day, which is a very normal state of weather.
Yeah, so I've heard. Yeah, like, the three days I was there were extremely bright sunshine, and I talked to my Moscow friends when I got back and said, oh, the weather was so fantastic, and they were like, you got lucky. It's normally never nice for 3 days
in a row.
Oh
yeah, it's we had kind of an unusually sunny summer this summer, but that is, it's true, it's unusual. And so yeah, I got back from being in like Greece where it was mostly sunny, and I know it seems like banal to talk about the weather, but it really is like important because I've just been like kind of drowsy for at least today. I just like have been listening to the rain outside and like trying not to fall asleep, and it's just like, I don't know, I'm a little scared.
The weather is conspiring against my efforts to stay awake. Yeah, I mean, presumably that was a bit of an adjustment, because, I mean, moving to Moscow for me, as someone who grew up in a fairly northern country, the long and short days were a bit more extreme than they are here, but it wasn't a big systemic thing for me, whereas for my wife, who's from Pennsylvania, it was kind of like weird.
Yeah.
It was just like, this is unusual. I'm used to normal length days.
Or just like, I think of the weather in St. Petersburg or the seasons in St. Petersburg as something I'm still kind of acclimating to, even though it's not because of like cold or something, because I am from New York and we have seasons and we have winter and it gets cold.
Yeah.
But it's really about the light and the like the sort of what I see as like a kind of manic cyclicality of the seasons, where you get like these huge swings of like really sort of euphoria in the spring when the white nights are happening. You're just like not sleeping a lot and everything is like very active and people are outside a lot, to this kind of other swing of things that starts happening, you know, now. And then like you get really deep into the darkness in December, where people are kind of more inside and like gathering inside and gathering in bars. Yeah. And there's also,
it's like, it's always nighttime.
Yeah. And it's also cool. It's like I like it. I mean, I enjoy it, and it's a different sort of like social interaction, because you start having like, even just the fact that bars are more crowded and popular in the winter, for example, you kind of switches everyone's mode of being, because it's harder to be outside on the street. But
because it's horrible, yeah, and dark,
right? Because it's like, even if it's not cold, it's rainy or whatever, like now. And it's not so much like, oh, I hate the winter and I love the white nights, but the white nights is actually a really important part of my experience of Petersburg, I think, because I first came here when I first came in 2012 when I was studying. It was in mid-June, so it was like the peak of the white nights.
Yeah,
and I have a very strong memory of that, and that being something that, like, sort of, I don't know, immediately gave me, in terms of, like, impressions, immediately gave me a very positive but very, like, surreal impression of the city, because we got there, I was with the group of students, we got there in, like, the evening, and, you know, we're, like, shipped to our little hotel and on the bus or whatever, and everyone's tired because we just traveled from New York, but, like, so this combination, this like weird mental state of a combination of like jet lag and also I hadn't traveled that far in my life before, and then also the white nights, just like, I don't know, somehow put me into this like really specific mental state. And then we went out for the first time, like out walking around like 11 p.m. And I really remember it was like as though it was the middle of the day and all these people were walking around outside, like eating ice cream, and like there were like kids walking around, and it was just like little families, I don't know, on the embankment. And I was like, okay, it was very surreal feeling. And it was like my really actually first images of the city, which was cool. And I've kind of like, that feeling has been something that I enjoy having, this like surreal quality of the city. And it's something that I connect to not only the White Nights, but in general, like an experience of St. Petersburg where it could be the lighting sometimes, or it could be how things are often like hidden and hard to find. There's sort of a mysterious quality of the city that I like. Things, it's hard to, I don't know, get places sometimes because they're like hidden in some back courtyard area or something. But yeah.
Yeah, it does have, I mean, maybe this is unfair, and part of it's just, you know, St. Petersburg is still novel to me, because I only went there once. It kind of has a more, like, it sounds like a ridiculous word, but more of a magical quality to it. And Moscow is much more kind of like, because I lived there, kind of just down and dirty and grungy and, you know, very much a working city, but, like, not a city that I can romanticize as easily. But, yeah, as you were saying, that's an awful lot of novelty, like, converging on your consciousness at once.
Yeah, and it's fun to still be able to like get that feeling a little bit now when the city is like so familiar to me, because it's not that big a city. So yeah. I really do have like, it's completely different now because I, you know where everything is. I have sort of like a different mental image. And it also has to do with how people write about and like depict St. Petersburg, because that feeling that I'm trying to describe, which may or may not sort of be familiar to people listening, is something that is described in, you know, like Gogol's short stories about St. Petersburg, or like Dostoevsky, where it's captured there, you know, like the surrealness.
Yeah, like that comes up quite a lot in Crime and Punishment, which is years since I've read it. But yeah, a lot of it is like the kind of the frenzy of being in St. Petersburg over the summer when it's super hot and everyone's out of the city and you're just kind of wandering around and
losing your mind. Yeah,
it's all. Yeah, it's yeah. But Smith, so yeah, you've been to Russia a couple of times now. Did coming back this time around, having done your podcast for a year, did that kind of change? Did that affect your experience at all, do you think? Or yeah, how did the two times differ or were similar? Or yeah.
Yeah, so we had started the podcast the last time I was there, the first time around. But it was much younger at the time. And just the quality of the trip was different because I was working on a project. So I was like working a lot and didn't really get the opportunity to see the city. And the weather was different. This last time I was here, it was like really, it was like t-shirt weather. And so Lily's working. So I just like would get a lot of days to myself to just wander around the city. And that was, I don't know, really nice. I think that in terms of like, how I relate to the city differently because of the podcast, I guess I just like, I feel at this point pretty familiar with a lot of aspects of like Russian history and like hearing Lily tell stories. I mean, I've always heard Lily tell stories, but hearing her tell stories about the city a lot just gave me kind of a sense of familiarity that maybe I didn't have the first time I was there. And that was really nice to just feel like slightly more comfortable and like, you know, I don't speak Russian, but even still feeling like less like a tourist and just able to be casually in the city versus feeling like I stand out more. I'm not sure. There's definitely like a few times where people spoke to me like in Russian asking me for like help or something like that. And even though I had to be like, oh, I don't understand what you're saying. Sorry. Like, it's still like kind of nice to be mistaken.
Yeah. I'm the last person you should ask.
Yeah, really. So yeah, I don't know. I think also in terms of the podcast, there's definitely a thing that I think both Lily and I have trained our brains to do, which is like kind of always on the hunt for things to talk about. And so kind of approaching the city in that, I don't want to say like productive way, but in a way where I'm like maybe more actively engaged with the small things that are going on around me in case I would like want to talk about them later. That's, I think, a kind of nice, mindful way to be in a place.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I could definitely relate to the whole, it's nice being in a place that is still new to you, but not feeling like totally like you stick out like a sore thumb. I recently visited Riga, which I'd never been to before, but just the fact that it's former Soviet Union, and obviously, you know, it's a different ethnic group majority, but there are lots of Russians there and the buildings are quite similar and some of the way things run are similar. It felt like weirdly comfortingly familiar just because I had that contextual knowledge about a lot of things. Obviously not wanting to say everything is the same, but there was a lot of overlap, so that was kind of nice.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I really loved your intro, Smith, as far as like the reason you're doing the podcast. That's something I really appreciate, because whilst I always feel like I have to be careful not to seem like, because I'm saying, you know, hey, Russia's cool, like that people will think that I'm a Putin apologist or an apologist for the way things are done, but at the same time it really frustrates me how simplistic the coverage is over here. And I see a fair amount of US media as well, and it seems very kind of like all Russians think this way and are kind of bad and our enemy, so you know.
Totally.
Yeah, but I mean there is a big political content to a lot of the episodes you do, but you also do like more broader episodes as well. It's kind of almost like a Russian smorgasbord of interesting content. Do you have like personal favorite episodes that you've done? I guess I'll ask this to Smith first.
We've at times indexed what our favorite episodes are for different reasons, but the ones that come to mind for me are, I really like the soy episode because I think I mostly just like it because it's so nice to listen to Kino's music.
Oh, so yeah.
I really liked doing that one a lot. The recent ones we did in August about the whole Telegram saga stuff, we did a two-part one there where we like interviewed a bunch of different people. We interviewed one of the lawyers at Agora, which is like this human rights network of lawyers who's representing Telegram at the European Court of Human Rights. We talked to him and we talked to some like IT experts, and Lily talked to what's Mikhail's like title, like the director of this internet digital freedom group.
Yeah.
And we just really got like an intense and like complex understanding of the Telegram case, which like there has been coverage of the Telegram case in Western media for sure, but nothing, I mean, as far as we can tell, nothing as comprehensive and nothing like in audio form. So that was really cool, just to like, it took us a really long time and it was like a lot of effort, and to have learned to just feel like I have a really intense understanding of this like one specific case was very satisfying. So yeah, I would say like those two. And then there have been just interviews we've done that I've really enjoyed doing. And actually, I feel like we did an episode recently with Lily's friend Nastia, where I think that was actually the one where we talked about how the differences in British and American English.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think I was just listening to that yesterday or the day before. I was kind of catching up on a few episodes I hadn't heard. I feel really embarrassed now that the Telegram 2 is a couple that I haven't actually listened to yet. But the soy one is... Yeah, I can definitely see why that's a favorite, and I really owe you both a lot of thanks, because I was kind of aware of Kino being like kind of a big deal from my time in Moscow, but I don't think I'd ever consciously like gone out of my way to listen to them. I'd probably heard them in the background and stuff, and yeah, it was really like musically right up my street, and I have been listening to them kind of in heavy rotation now, you know, for the last
day.
Yeah, so
that's really nice. Yeah, we actually, this is like kind of a downer on this topic, but we ended up going to his grave while I was in St. Petersburg, because he's buried in St. Petersburg in this big cemetery, and we went there, and like, I don't know, it was just a weird scene. Like, we approached, and at first we were going to like video it, and then we just like kind of realized it wasn't the place to video. And
no, that sounded, yeah, like you say, a really weird
place. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's that way. Yeah, it is sad. It is that way all the time, where there's just like, I mean, there's people there. It seems like they're there a lot, who obviously like really cared about him and Kino and had like some sort of like obsession with him, in the way that like certain rock stars have, you know, obsessive fans.
Yeah.
But it is just like a reminder that even, you know, however many years after his death, you know, like 20 something years after his death, he still holds this like really intense magnetism for people.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been over to Seattle, but the closest thing I can kind of imagine for people from the West is Kurt Cobain, really. But I mean, obviously, rather different circumstances around Soy's premature death. But yeah, I feel like that's the most obvious analog in terms of like what a big deal he was at the time.
Yeah, I didn't think of that comparison. That's a good comparison.
Yeah, we were comparing him to John Lennon, but
that's
yeah,
not as good.
Okay.
Kurt Cobain is a better example.
Yeah.
Because of the underground also thing.
Yeah, that aspect. Yeah, whereas obviously, yeah, the Beatles were...
mainstream,
you know. Yeah, which means they suck, right?
Basically.
No.
Who even likes them?
Well, I like them, but you know, not the popular songs. No.
I love them. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yes, important not to go on the record as going, oh yeah, Beatles, overrated.
I love all the songs, including the popular ones. It's true.
But yeah, so you should definitely check out that episode, listeners, and Kino as well, if you're at all into, like, I know, how would you even define that sound?
Soviet underground rock. I don't know. Yeah, it's like I'm trying to think of a band that there's a comparison to. Yeah, it's rock music, but like
lo-fi.
lo-fi rock, but like more like upbeat. You know, yeah. it's not low. I feel like oftentimes like lo-fi music is associated with like maybe more like punky stuff or stuff that's more emotionally downtrodden, but
yeah.
Kino does not have that sound.
But there is like 80s elements. Like I can just hear some drumming in my head.
And I know you don't agree with me on this one, but there is that first album of theirs where there's like a lot of Hawaii undertones.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I did not agree with you. I just was like, Hawaii? I don't know if that was what I would have said.
It's straight up luau music.
But, really. Okay. But I would have said, I don't know, something else. But I'm just thinking of like even the song that opens the episode, which I'm blanking out right now. Do you remember, Elizabeth?
Is that Grupa Krovi? Is it that one?
What?
I can't remember.
Oh, maybe it is.
Grupa Krovi.
Yeah, that song, like that opening is like very, in my limited music knowledge mind, is like 80s sounding.
Like, yeah, no, I think that's definitely fair.
So it's not just like, I don't know. Like I was trying to make rock like slightly more specific. That's what I said. 80s.
When you say 80s rock, someone's going to imagine like AC/DC and kind of like screaming and, you know, like devil horns. And it's more like art rock. I mean, some of their stuff sounds a bit like Interpol, who obviously are a much more recent band. I mean, still technically going, but yeah, Spokojnaya Noć. I'm just kind of like, if Interpol haven't heard this song, then it's just kind of like their sound just really sounds very similar to this. But yeah, but yeah. Anyway, I'm sure we'll get back onto the music thing because some of the music stuff in the film we're going to watch I thought was pretty interesting. So yeah, we should probably introduce the film that we're going to watch today. So the film we're going to watch today is Brilliantovaya Ruka, The Diamond Arm, which is from 1969, the year it was released. It's directed by Leonid Gaidai. And Smith, that was your pick. So what inspired you to choose this one?
Well, it wasn't actually my pick. I asked Lily.
You were the conduit.
Yeah, she was the conduit for my pick.
Yeah, I was the conduit. I'm often the conduit for Lily's things. But, well, it wasn't your pick either, Lily. Let's give credit to the person.
Well, it was my pick from a limited selection I was given.
So, yeah, basically I was like, Lily, what should we watch? And then she's like, let me ask my friend Polia. And then Polia gave her a list, and then Lily chose The Diamond Arm.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Did I give you a list, Smith? Or was I just any Russian film you want to watch?
Yeah, I think that you were just like, is there something that you guys, maybe like something you guys have been wanting to watch? Or yeah, it was open-ended.
Yeah, but it was a decision of the collective leadership.
Yeah, it was like I have been meaning to watch more Soviet film, and this movie is from a list that my friend gave me, that like her version of a short, you know, course in Russian film. She studied film partly, and this one was like, this is like such a cult classic that it's one of the ones that you sort of like have to watch. And I was like, okay, well, I haven't seen this, so we should watch it. And so that was the thinking.
So, yeah, I mean, for this podcast, I've covered a couple of Leonid Gaidai films. One episode's already out. It's the Ivan Vasilievich Changes Profession one. And we've also got Kidnapping Caucasian Style is how it tends to get translated. So a couple of Shurik films. Have either of you two seen the Shurik films or any other Leonid Gaidai?
Yes.
Okay. Wait, I
like didn't put two and two together that that's the same person, the same director. The like films with the, wait, is it called?
Shurik. He's the, well, he's blonde in the first one. He's like, I guess.
What's the name of like? What, is it the like? The
Yeah. It's Operatsiya U is the first one,
yes.
And then Kavkazskaya Plyennitsa, which is kidnapping Caucasian style, and then Ivan Vasilievich changes profession. They're like a, I mean, I don't think they were designed that there was always going to be a trilogy, but there were three films with this one guy.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that that was the same director, and I love, well, at least Operatsiya U, I watched, and the, I think the kidnapping one I've seen at least parts of, but Smith, you haven't seen any of those, have you?
No.
I'll have to show you the first one. It's like a, isn't it sort of like a series of mini
films? It's quite episodic. Yeah. I've only seen a bit of it because my Russian teacher made me watch it during class, and then she got me to describe what happened as kind of like a language practice exercise. So I haven't seen all of that one, but I've seen all of the other two. So Smith, have you seen many Russian films at all, or?
I haven't really. I feel like I've seen maybe around 10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's like a base. That's not like this is the second one you've ever seen. So
right.
Okay. Well, once we've watched it, we'll have to talk about like, was it a surprise compared to the other stuff you'd seen? All right, so that's the film kind of introduced, but what we do each time, for those of you who are new to the show, we like to launch into the film discussion part of the episode by speaking a little bit of Russian, just the one word, which is «поехали». And in terms of what it just means in Russian, it just means off we go, but it's kind of like got a bit more cultural significance than just being like off we go. And you two understand that probably better than most, as you did a whole episode on the space race. So yeah, why is «поехали» a thing?
Okay, «поехали» is a thing because it is the word that the legendary Yuri Gagarin said when they were just about to take off in 1961, I think. It was like during the takeoff of the Vostok, is what I read. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I believe that was the name of the rocket, which means east in Russian, because they tend to name everything east if they have to name things.
Right.
Because we are not the West. Stop trying to say that we're the same
one
as you guys. We must emphasize
the
our
other West.
I'm. It's nice that you bring that up because it's not something that I like think about on a daily basis. And people say «поехали» all the time, you know, in everyday conversation.
When they say that, are they quoting Gagarin, or is it, or they're not really?
No, I mean only in the sense of like, it's. If you said to someone like, oh my god, that's what Gagarin said, they'd probably be like, oh yeah. But it's he said it because it's such a commonplace thing to say, and it literally means it's in the past tense. It's like a little bit confusing. So how would you explain it? It literally means like we went.
Yeah, but it kind of more means we're off.
We're off. Yeah.
Or kind of like, let's go, but we've already started going. It's kind of weird in that regard, because as you say, with the past tense. And there's a version for when you're walking, which is «пошли».
Right, right.
Wait, Lily, is that the sort of thing where, like, you're talking like when, like, a mother is reprimanding her child and she, like, is instructing them to stop doing something, but she says it in the past tense, like, you have already stopped doing the thing? Is that...
It actually probably is grammatically similar. I've never like really gotten into figuring out why the past tense is used in this case, because it's used almost as an imperative, which is the same as what if in a commanding situation. It's like let's go, it would be more of an imperative. And it's one of those things that like you just learn when you're learning Russian and then it's never explained. So it's something that I should look into.
Just say this and you'll be fine, because that's what everyone does.
And like, I remember that very well. Like when I would leave the house when I was studying abroad, that was like one of the things I knew how to say. I mean, I knew how to say a few things, but I would be like, "Я пошла." It's like I went.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I already. And people will like shoo people out of the door and be like, "Пошли, пошли, let's go, let's go."
Right. I think that the phrase, I didn't realize how symbolic the Gagarin's utterance of it is, but it makes sense, I guess, in that context, definitely, of like this really important event. But I also really like how it's like it's very Russian in a sense, in that it's the fact that he said that is very Russian, I guess. And by that I just mean that like the Russian language can be very compact sometimes, and that's like such a compact
thing
to say.
It's like one word.
It's like, yeah, it's so laconic. He's like about to go into space. He's like, "Let's go."
Let's go. Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of like that it's, because it's similarly famous to One Small Step for Man, but it's way less of a set piece. Because, like, you know, Neil Armstrong, clearly that was something he was like, "I'm going to set out onto the moon, and that's kind of a big deal, so I'm going to want it to be, you know, something rhetorically impressive." Whereas Gagarin is kind of like, "We're off. Yay."
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't say the yay bit, it's, but it's much more like, yeah, unfussy.
Yeah. It's so that, and you can't even use that like one small step for man. One, that's something. Did that he said one small step for man, one great leap or whatever for mankind.
Well, that's the thing. It's
a man.
It was supposed to be a man, and like either the broadcast cut out or he just like messed up because he was nervous, because otherwise it's kind of a tautology.
God damn it. Yeah. That's true, and I never thought about it.
It is. He was probably like, "Oh, idiot." They couldn't have changed that in the transition. They could have just lied.
He practices the line like 700 times and he's like,
and fucks it up.
No.
From his studio where they recorded that, because they did it really
good. Yeah.
We'll have to fake the whole moon landing over again because Neil couldn't get his act together.
I like that.
I think of it as being a big deal mainly because when I first studied Russian, like formally in classes, the textbook that we were given was called Poyekhali, and I think it had like a spaceship on the front. So I was kind of like, "Why is it called that? Oh, right. That makes sense now." So, yeah. So maybe I'm assigning a bigger significance to it than it really deserves and actually has in Russian culture. But hey, it's working.
Well,
so
it has a Wikipedia page dedicated to it as that phrase.
Oh, no way.
And there's no English translation. So it is important for Russian.
Right. Someone should do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, we should say the word. So, 3, 2, 1. Поехали! Поехали! We've just watched Brilliantovaya Ruka, The Diamond Arm, directed by Leonid Gaidai from 1969. And before we talk about what we thought of the film, Smith and Lily, you're going to give us a tag team version of the setup to the plot. So spoiler alerts, if you don't want to know what happens, then you should probably watch the film. It's available on YouTube for free, so that's nice. But yeah, over to you, Smith and Lily.
All right, okay. Lily, let me try. I'll try to just talk about the beginning part so that we don't spoil too much. But the premise is that there is some sort of jewel smuggling situation, I guess. Are they supposed to be in Turkey in the beginning?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. From Turkey to Russia. And the way that this smuggling is supposed to take place is that this man who's on like a little cruise tour gets off in, I guess, Istanbul and is supposed to break his arm and get a cast with the jewels wrapped up in the cast. But because everybody in this movie is a fool of some sort or the other, they end up taking the wrong man and wrapping his arm up with jewels while he's passed out. And so he comes to and he has this like bejeweled arm. You can't see it because the jewels are like wrapped up in the plaster of the arm cast. And he gets back on his little like touring ship with the guy who's supposed to have the jewels. And from there, basically, the entire movie is like the playing out of the jewel smugglers trying to get the jewels back and the guy who has the jewels trying to like thwart them along with the police. Lily, anything to add?
He doesn't actually have to break his arm, but...
No, yeah, no, his arm isn't actually broken, yeah.
I think that's a lot of detail. I think that's good. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a great setup, because I normally do a more thorough summary of the plot at this time, but I feel like a lot of the humor comes from the unexpected, so... Because, I mean, I'm going to just straight off say, I really like this, but how about you two? You know, did you enjoy it?
Yes, I was waiting to see if Smith wanted to answer. I definitely did. I've now seen it like a couple of times in preparation. And it was fun to do that because the first time was like more about just like watching it in an entertaining way. Oh, wait, no, wait, we're supposed to only watch it once. Whatever. Okay. I ruined the premise. But
matter.
I... Basically, the time that I watched it... more carefully, it was cool because like, as on the one hand, it's a very like slapstick movie, as you said, another one of his films is, and maybe that's like sort of his style, but on the other hand, it has these like really artistic, I don't know, sort of like interesting details and attention to detail,
like flourishes,
yeah, that are fun to catch, like if you notice them and like you know, follow them along. It's cool.
Yeah.
How about
you, Smith? Did you enjoy it as well, or more skeptical?
No, I definitely enjoyed it. I think that I'm not super drawn to like slapstick humor, and so when I watch it, I'm laughing out loud, but I'm not bored either. Like, I'm very interested in it, and I think visually it's like a very non-boring thing to look at. Also, like, side note that I think almost increased my enjoyment of watching it is when Lily and I, we watched part of it on the plane, and there were Russians sitting behind us, and they were, like, peering around our seats so they could watch it with us for, like, a large percentage of it. And they couldn't, like, we had headphones on, so they couldn't even hear it, but they just, like, were really enjoying the fact that we were watching it.
Yeah, and the lady left of me was also, I mean, we were on a plane to Moscow, so it was a lot of mostly Russians, and the woman next to me was also looking over at it. And people, like, the people behind us, I heard them, like, sort of repeating the lines. Like, they just know all the lines. So, I mean...
Which is
fun to sort of like interact. I knew that would happen too when we were like we're about to watch it. I was like, people are gonna like that we're watching this. It's like such a thing, kind of. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, did they know that you were a couple of foreigners watching the film, or were you just a couple of people watching the film?
No. I think they heard us probably speaking English, and we also had English subtitles, so it was
Okay. So there was big giveaway. So it was kind of like an element of like, oh, cool, these non-Russian people are watching this Russian classic.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's what they thought. Cool.
Yeah, I was a bit worried, actually. Like, sometimes the films that I cover on here, I'm just like, I know the film's, like, status and how beloved it is, so I'm kind of worried that I'm not going to like it and that people are just going to be like... You know, because I do have some people in Russia who listen, and they'll just be like, "Huh, Philistine." Of course he wouldn't get it, because he doesn't have a deep Russian soul. It's like, well, I just don't know the culture as well as you guys, but, you know, that's a topic for another day. But, So we all agree we liked it, despite it being more slapsticky, which... is sometimes less people's cup of tea. What did you think of the characters?
Well, that was, I mean, this movie is pretty notable in that there's like at least the two main characters are really, really famous Soviet actors. Russian, I guess. And then actually really the whole a lot of the cast is. So it's just like this, in that sense, like it's like when you watch any movie with a really good cast, it sort of like doesn't exactly matter like what exactly is going on, because it's just a pleasure, at least for me, to watch the actors themselves.
All these really watchable people.
Yeah, and I didn't know that much about Nakulin, is that his name? I had seen him in other movies, but I didn't realize like sort of his status as this like important person for Soviet humor in general. He's an actor, he's like a famous clown, he ran the circus at some point in Moscow.
Oh, no way, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's big figure that in the circus world. And it's, clowns are just really weird, interesting characters, and I think it's like
yeah,
it's cool to see a clown acting. And then there's, I mean, he's a very obviously talented actor, not just a, you know.
Yeah,
because you told me like at the beginning, like, oh, this guy's a famous clown, and I didn't get like super clown vibes from him, you know. Like if you hadn't said that, I don't think I would have been like, this guy seems like a clown.
But he does have that kind of like hangdog kind of glum clown face,
yeah,
which is very funny.
True, yeah.
But yeah, no, I was vaguely aware of the clown thing, but yeah, I don't think I would have guessed that if I didn't know it.
Yeah, because he's not doing like necessarily, he's not really playing that same role in this movie, at least. But a lot of it's also because I think it's like his slapstickness is a little bit diluted, or you're distracted by it, by the slapstick qualities of all the other characters, the main characters, like Mironov.
Yeah, he's not the one guy doing pratfalls and everyone else is just, you know, going about their
right.
business.
Wait, I'm just, what's his name, Mironov? Or what's the name of the main character who's, yeah, Mironov is the character who plays the main bad guy, I guess.
Yeah, main criminal.
And jewel stealer. And his physical comedy, or just his physicality, is also really, really present, if not like more, it's more sort of flamboyant than Nikulin's. So you, them together is like, you know, it's not like, it sort of dilutes the fact that Kulin is actually like a clown. Yeah.
A literal clown. Yeah. No, it's definitely true. And even his like facial expressions and stuff aren't super over exaggerated, which I obviously appreciate. And yeah, I think you're right that, what's his name? Mironov. What's his name in the movie, though?
Gesha.
Gesha, yeah. He is definitely, like, the more physically, yeah, flamboyant's the right word. Like, he does this particular thing with his hair where he's, like, flipping it back with his head, like, very visibly. And, like, I feel like there's a lot of him, like, I don't know, like moping, him just like using his body in a very specific way, or like when he has this like vision of the like angel boy, I feel like he's like very
dramatic.
Yeah, very dramatic.
It's interesting that like his character kind of goes through a transformation in the movie that I didn't really like see maybe the first time around, which is that it's just like sort of his downfall, which is kind of a classic like bad guy thing, I guess. But the fact that he is so exuberant, like bubbly in the beginning. Like, remember, he dances and he's singing and he's like, his physicality is huge and really positive, but he's also really together. Like, his suit is nice and stuff. And then like,
yeah, suave is the word that I was thinking of.
Yeah, suave. And he just, in the very first scene, he's like, he's got his shit together. Like, he accomplishes the first task, like, really smoothly. I mean,
what is the first task?
The thing with the cane, remember? Like, it's like a mini scene, so that you know what's going on.
Yeah.
And then he's just like, you know, he accomplishes it. He does his thing. And so you have some context. But then,
and he's handsome. So you're like, oh, okay.
And yeah, he's handsome and his hair's combed. And and you have this contrast between him and Nikulin's character, who is kind of like, immediately you see that he's kind of like a little bit of a dunce. Like, he's a
He's a bozo.
Sweet
yeah.
Sweet dunce.
Yeah. I mean, he's not aggressive or like bozos. Maybe are not a good word because that sounds kind of like more like a knucklehead. But yeah, he's just like amiably dopey.
Dopey. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you kind of feel like because he's going on this like mini cruise by himself. His wife and family aren't coming along, and he seems like someone who sounds awful, but kind of needs his wife around to look after him because he's just hapless.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely hapless. I mean, he leaves his daughter on like a luggage cart in the beginning, and then like
that's how we're introduced. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. That's how we're introduced to him, and then he's being interviewed, but like he doesn't answer. Like the interviewer's like, "Oh, what do you do?" And then like the wife just answers all the questions for him. What is that though that he's on going on a little tour by himself?
As far as I understood, won something, right? Like,
yeah, maybe that's something I missed.
I think he won like a little, like he gets to go, you know, I don't know. This seems like something that would happen more in the late or whatever we call it, starting from the thaw Soviet period, which is what this is very much like deep thaw period. And like, you know, he wins some kind of thing that lets him go. I'm pretty sure he wins it because I don't think he's just decided to go. Maybe he's just decided to go because maybe he got like a little bonus or something. But I feel like the interviewer
it's like a work-related thing. Yeah.
Yeah, like maybe he's just getting like a little vacation reward. But I feel like it's like one of those things where, you know, it's this exciting thing, but it's unusual. Obviously, we can get into that, how he like, you know, he's going to the other place that's like the outside stuff. But at the same time, it's like, not that great because like when the interviewer is like, so you're all going, they're like, oh no, just he's going. It's like they can't all go.
Yeah,
that's like this tragedy to it too. We're like,
and he doesn't really want to go, and his wife is kind of like, no, you should go, it'll be good for you, you know, you should see the world, because I get the impression he has to chip in like some of the cost as well, which like as a prize is pretty crappy, because she says something about like, because he's like, oh, but we wanted to buy you that fur coat. And she's kind of like, well, that can wait.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Maybe it's not a prize. Maybe it's just like a vacation, but she's paying for it.
Yeah. Because
the fur coat. You're right.
Yeah, maybe it's
And that's such a thing, too. Like, that's such a symbolic, I don't know, choice of object, you know, like the the coveted fur coat.
Yeah. Status. I love because it is quite slapsticky, which, you know, often is viewed as a simplistic form of humor, but they just do, like you were saying, the intros to the characters are so deft. Like, they tell you lots of stuff that you need to know about this guy, or, you know, Mironov's character. Like, he's kind of a screw up as far as the movie goes, but you have that intro scene to show that he's not normally like this. As much as anything, it's the fact that when stuff goes to plan, he's really competent and on it, but he's kind of playing catch up the whole film. So that's kind of nice to see the context there. I thought that was really deft, clever filmmaking.
Yeah, and you get a lot of information in the first scene. I just rewatched the first scene like right before also, just because it's really like symbolically heavy. It's kind of front loaded in a way, because you have this mini version of the entire film. And by that, I just mean like the quick contraband interaction with the cane. And you just see that happening smoothly. And that's sort of like, this is how it should go, like a micro version. And then you also have like the intro to the two characters, as you said, the two main characters. And you sort of in that, at least intro, see them as very contrasting, because it's like smooth shiny suit man and like sort of dilapidated dopey man who's also wearing a white suit. He's like wearing a light suit and the other one's wearing a dark suit, so it's like very contrasting. And then you have the introduction immediately to the boss, like the chief or the whatever, how they translate it, the chef. And that character is literally just a hand with a jewel on the
ring
finger, right hand, and you just see the hand closing a door. And that like is the trope that gets repeated and repeated in the film, is that hand closing a like really extravagant set of locks on like some very heavy metal door. And like that's all in the first scene. And I remember the first time I watched it being like, oh, it's the diamond arm or the diamond hand, because like that hand has a diamond or some jewel on it. And that's like, I was like, okay, that's the reason the movie's called that. Like, that's what I thought.
Yeah. Well, that's actually an important point to, okay, maybe not an important point, but a point worth bringing up is the fact in Russian, there's kind of an ambiguity because hand and arm are normally the same words. They do have a separate word for hand, but it doesn't get used very much to the point that, I want to say it's kissed, but
that's finger, but yeah.
Oh.
I mean, no, there's no word for hand. It's just like words for fingers, for palm of the hand.
Yeah, but you kind of use it when you're being really specific. But yeah, if you say something is in your hand, it's v rukie, which like, and ruka is like the arm word. So that's how you can have a situation where someone can have a diamond on their finger and it be still like the diamond arm. So,
right.
Yes.
So the translation... That's a good point. And the translation sort of necessarily misses that nuance because the translation of the title, because you can't translate it as the diamond arm hand. So you have to just choose between one. And like they chose arm, which makes sense because in the end the cast is on his arm. But
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But there's that level of duality and nuance that you just don't get.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, that we don't have a word for your full arm.
Or leg. Same with Russian, with leg.
Yeah.
Kind of fucked up, actually.
Well.
Yeah. Well, it's like fucked up on both accounts.
Well,
like
I think it's fucked up. Yeah, I was meaning it's fucked up on the Russian account because I remember
it's confusing.
That messing with me, when I first learned it. I was like, but my foot. And it's like, it's really context-based. Like, if I say my foot is hurting, it's usually like understood if I can, like, it depends on the context, basically.
What about like you put a shoe on a leg?
Well, do you say I put my shoe on my foot ever? I'm trying to think let me just think.
Yeah, I mean, you could, like, you know, if you're helping like a little kid put their shoe on or something. Like that.
You would say, you would say probably, you would just say naga, which is this like word for both foot and leg. You would say that in that context. I mean,
but it is one of those ones where you go, why would the language evolve that way? Our way seems more logical.
Yeah, it does. In a way. But then it's just like, it's one of those things where there isn't like need for specialization according to this language, unless you need to say my heel or my arch of my foot or my toe.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
When you need to get really granular, yeah.
But it's funny because, like, I don't know. I guess we just feel like English feels like it needs that differentiation more.
Whereas Russian, we've kind of got into this by talking about поехали versus пошли. Like, Russian feels the need to specify whether you're going on foot or whether you're traveling in some kind of vehicle, be it like a sled, a car, or a rocket.
You know, right, and like, you can get really specific.
Aren't we just going?
Yeah, and technically it's like, there really are different words for you're going by foot, by car with wheel, or by vehicle with wheels, by vehicle that flies, or by vehicle that goes in the water.
Yes, sorry. Yes, I was wrong with saying sled. Yeah, yeah.
Rusty. It's like, or like katatsa is like, would be used for sleigh things. It's like a whole other word. It's like, I remember that we had a whole book in Russian that is the verbs of motion.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Now I'm getting traumatic flashbacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Russian is infuriatingly specific when it wants to be.
And then it's just like, hand, arm, whatever. Go fuck yourself.
We don't care. You can figure this out. You're looking. So we've talked a bit about the main male characters. I'm pretty sure this film wouldn't pass the Bechdel test, but it does have some pretty important female characters. How did you feel about them?
Okay.
I liked the super a lot. I'm trying to remember like specific lines of hers.
Well, she has all the our people lines.
We should explain. She's the building superintendent or building manager of the apartment where Semyon and Nadia live. Yes.
Nadia. And she has it out for him. It kind of without explanation, like maybe she's always sort of hated him. But the first scene of them together, they seem to get along, and then he offers her a gift that she dislikes, and then after that she seems to like, basically, yeah, she's just like following him around a lot and like, I don't know, telling his wife where he's been, those sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, because initially she wants him to give like a little talk to, I guess, the residents of the building, because right. It's like, you got to go somewhere yeah. that was interesting, so everyone's going to hear about it. And for some reason, she thinks he's going to New York, and he was just like, oh, I went to Istanbul, actually. And she's like, oh, whatever, same difference.
Yeah.
It's just like, what?
Yeah, that character, so the two main female characters are the superintendent and his wife, right? That's...
Yeah.
And the whatever that woman's name who
But she's not as fully a main character because she's not in the beginning.
Yeah, she's like a third act character, but we should definitely still talk about her at some point.
Yeah, she's important. She's like in the triumvirate of female characters. She's definitely an important one. And like for the superintendent character, yeah, she really reminds you sort of that you're in the Soviet Union of a particular time, and she kind of brings the like Soviet party line and to a sort of absurd point.
Yeah.
And she's like that force.
That's quite surprising because, you know, because she's portrayed as being formidable but also kind of ridiculous at the same time.
Yeah.
I felt.
Definitely like to a point of absurdity, yeah, because she's like very anal and also very up in everyone's business, and like sure, in that sense she's sort of like the ideal what do you call the kind of people who are vigilante. She's like a vigilante. She's always like inspecting everyone's behavior and then reporting it because she has this position of authority in the like apartment, and she, you know, is in charge of announcing all the things, like the activities that are going to happen in the apartment building, like this talk she wants Semyon to give, and then also in charge of sort of publicly shaming people at certain points.
Yeah, wait, what's the interaction she has with the guy with the dog?
Oh, right. She's like really... yeah, uppity about the lawn, I guess, outside of the apartment building, and doesn't want people to walk dogs on it. And so she's like, just that's what she does. She sort of yells at tenants about various rules. And so she's like, get the dog off the lawn. And then like, Semyon says that in London? He's like, in London, people walk their dogs wherever they want or something like that. He's like, dogs are a man's best friend. And she like hates that phrase. She's like,
and she kind of like strongly implies that in decadent capitalist countries, maybe. I mean, she never specifically says that, but that's kind of like the implication feel.
Yeah, doesn't she say like in our country, or she says like here, the like superintendent is a man.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that is what she says. I was trying to remember that. It's kind of interesting because she's the in this movie that is like full of fools, she is weirdly like the most competent. Like her strategies usually play out in her favor, and like she follows Semyon. She follows him around, and like she's more successful than like any of the other characters who are also trying to follow
the professional
him.
Crooks. Yeah.
Right.
And she's like this. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the whole sort of satirical, what I think of as satirical anti-Western, actually it's just anti-outside because it's not just the West, anti-non-Soviet like sort of trope in the movie.
Yeah,
she makes it satirical by over-dramatizing it, and like the example of the scene that you mentioned where she sort of says like it doesn't matter if it's Istanbul or New York, it's like a perfect example because she's just like collapsing them and
just lumping the whole rest of the world as being like non-Soviet, non-communist, therefore doesn't matter, does it?
You were there, and then they use like a lot of the rest of the film, they use like the word there, so they say like from there, atuda, they're like, where did you get that? It's from there. And they use this there to be like this abstract other place. And like I also like how she's this sort of representing this like party line or whatever, this like good Soviet citizen.
Upstanding
and keeping everyone like following all the rules. And like when she first looks at the things that Simeon brought back from the trip. That was also like such a symbolic moment because she looks, I mean, I think he's joking when he says that that's a gift for her purpose, but she grabs a box and I feel like she's like, oh, this is beautiful because like it's a box that I can use and like put things in, and it has like a cute little decoration on the outside, and then yeah. when it ends up being like not just a box, yeah. but like a pointless toy.
And in the lead up to that, they set it up so well because you just see the wife looking a bit jealous. It's like he's got this really thoughtful present for this other woman, and she doesn't say anything of this. It's just her looking, and just I guess the way that they've set up the cameras and her just facial expression acting, and then there's the punchline, and it's just really well done.
Yeah, totally. And it ends up being like also symbolic because it's just like a pointless object because it's like yeah. has no sort of purpose.
You draw an attention to like the way the cameras are set up, and in that scene, like between the camera and the wife is like some like narrow thing, like maybe it's through a door, and that's a sort of scene that they kind of repeat over and over again. The one that comes to mind is Lily mentioned it in the beginning of the hand with the jewel on it, like closing all the doors, but there's also a peephole. That they look through a lot and the camera goes through it. So that kind of thing where you're like looking at something almost like fisheye or like narrow through a corridor onto somebody's face, I feel like is yeah. pretty common.
And the camera angle ends up being important for a couple of like the standout scenes or something that, or the scenes that leave regular reality. And those would be when the dream scene, when,
oh, yeah.
or that like, mm-hmm. yeah, freaky nightmare scene or whatever. And there's like, you know, you're sort of swimming and the color changes and stuff. And then there's like the close up on yeah, Moreno's face where he's doing this sort of dramatic facial acting where his like
yeah,
face is
yeah,
like
yeah.
quivering and stuff. And then like the restaurant scene, which is like the camera's just like swinging, you know, and it's like trying to show the sort of peak chaos moment. And it's kind of like nauseating. You guys remember what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I think so.
You mean when they're drinking at the restaurant?
Well, at the end, yeah, after they're drinking, he like sings and then there's like a total chaos moment.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And also there's one other like dream sequence, which is when he's drugged.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the end.
By the woman. And then like, it's unclear as the viewer, like, if the things are actually happening. Because, like, he's, like, with this woman alone in a hotel room. And then, like, he's having these, like, kind of, like, hallucinations. Yeah, where he's, like, imagining the super in this woman's outfit and, like, dancing and stuff. And then, like, suddenly, basically, like, all the characters in the movie are, like, suddenly in the doorway, like, being like, what are you doing
yeah,
in here?
And then yeah. he just yeah. passes out. Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. Sorry. I don't know what I was going to say. So...
I was just gonna comment that I didn't think about the fact that it really is like the whole cast is in the doorway at that very end scene. It's like very climactic, yeah. and you don't know if it's actually happening. And then the fisheye thing happens in that scene too, because it like fisheyes on his wife, and so that's sort of all that he cares about. Mm. That's all that he really is seeing.
And then what does he say? Like, something along the lines of like it's not me or it wasn't my fault or something like
that. No, she says
that. Oh no, that's her. Yeah, yeah. She says, yeah, I wasn't to blame.
Oh,
he came by himself, which I don't know whether that's an innuendo in Russian. I wondered whether it was, but maybe not.
No. I don't think so. I don't think so, but that's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Well, it's an innuendo in English.
Apparently, yeah, my mind's just in the gutter, but yeah, that whole scene, because obviously we've talked about her as being like the third like important female character. How did you both feel about her?
I mean, for like, she kind of comes in. I don't remember what her name is, or if you must know her name at some point.
Svetlana.
Okay, yeah, she kind of comes in after like the entire movie of these like. It's essentially two like men trying to get the jewels back from this guy's arm, and them failing in like slapsticky humorous ways like the entire film. And then she comes in as like the competent woman who's going to get the thing back from him finally after these like men have bungled it for the past hour and a half. And she's very like business like and like very, you know, just straightforward. And then
yeah, I'll get the job done type of thing.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't know, I didn't have any specific feelings about her past that, except that it is funny to see that kind of scene. Like I think that scene is like repeated in a lot of movies, but in other movies it's like taken seriously and it's like, oh, look at this sexy woman. But because she's doing that in the context of this like kind of ridiculous movie, and yeah, because he's such a ridiculous character, it also feels so
yeah bad. I was sorry, you go.
No, you go this time.
I was just going to say, I was quite surprised to see that sort of a scene in a Soviet film from the late 60s. Like, if it had been late 80s, I would have gone, okay. But yeah, I was quite surprised. Because she essentially, like, does a striptease, which, like, it's that whole scene, it's kind of emblematic of how dim-witted this the character Nikulin plays is, because I mean, she sets up this meeting at her hotel room, which, like, fair enough, you could understand him not figuring out that bit, but to the point where he comes in and she's wearing this like relatively sheer, very short dress thing, and then she's like, oh, well, you know, my friend's going to take a while to get here. But in the meantime, let's have a drink. And the fact that he's not like, huh, okay, something funny's going on here. He's just like obliviously like, okay, I guess. Yeah, I found that just kind of like, oh, man, this guy is really not the sharpest. But it's funny.
Yeah. I mean, he knows like what's going on overall, because like the police are also at the hotel like monitoring the situation, but he really doesn't try. He never tries to steer a situation in any direction. He's like a very passive character. Like you say, she offers him a drink and he's like, he doesn't really want to do it, but he's like, well, okay. And then as soon as she gives him like this giant glass of wine, he just like downs
it. And he just doesn't think that it's weird that she's not wearing normal clothes, you know.
Or he like does, he like knows that this is his assignment and he knows that she's not who she says she is, because he's like given the information. And then, I mean, he kind of like, well, he doesn't know that in the restaurant scene, actually, because at the time he still thinks they're just friends. But in any case, in the hotel scene, he does know it. But you're right, Smith. He's just like, once he's told the proper authorities like what he needs to tell, he isn't going to do anything on his own. He's just going to like,
right,
he's just physically present, and that's all. And he's not going to think about like, oh, she might try to drug me, or like, I shouldn't drink this thing, because like, that's the main thing. But he is sort of stalling, because like, he needs to stay there, because I think because he needs to like give the signal or whatever. I don't know what he needs to do. He needs to stall. Right?
Yeah. But then there's the signal that she's trying to give to the criminal accomplices who kind of set her up. And then that signal ends up being inadvertently sent in an extremely ridiculous way, which I will leave as a surprise. But just, yeah, I guess Soviet manufacturing, what can you say? Not always the most quality garments, apparently.
Yeah, that's true. That's a funny scene.
I was just kind of like, yeah, that's going to be embarrassing if that happens in a different situation. Just, you know, walking around. Ping! And they use the bullet sound effect, which is
yeah, that was another thing about the sound effects and stuff. There's a lot of maybe that's like a slapstick style thing, but there's a lot of clearly like artificial sound effects or things that are clearly other noises supplanted for, like, I don't know, like when somebody's smiling in a specific way or like doing something that would make a natural noise, it's like supplanted with an artificial one.
Yeah, it's like heightened or something.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly like slightly a sharp left-hand turn, but we've touched on the music. What did you think of that? Because we've got songs and we've also got like the incidental music. I mean, maybe if we talk about the songs first.
Okay, so there are two scenes, I'm pretty sure, where what character is singing and performing on screen, and that gives the movie a kind of light musical vibe, which I'm usually not into at all, but I like forgive these characters and this kind of movie a lot of things because it just like it just works. It somehow works. I think it's because of their physicality. And the like second singing scene in the restaurant is that sort of climactic chaos scene and is sort of more natural and less musically because he's actually on a stage.
He's gotten massively drunk and he's singing karaoke. So like you say, it's kind of like naturally built into the scene. But yeah, the earlier one is Mironov's character just burst into song. And that was funny for me because I'd heard that song before, actually quite a lot of times, but I didn't realize it was from this. This was literally from the textbook called Poyekhali that was just used as a listening exercise. But I'd obviously like, I'm sure it's said in there somewhere that like this is from the classic film Diamond Arm, but that had totally gone over my head. So that was kind of like, oh, I recognize this. So yeah, there you go. And yeah, I thought the songs were really funny and just like quite catchy. And like you say, the musical element worked quite well, although that was kind of a novel thing for me, like, because this is by no means a straight musical, but it just has a couple of these musical numbers in it, and that seems to be something that Guy Dai likes doing in his films. I mean, certainly in the Shurik ones there's a few of those.
I mean, with Mironov, it's one of those moments where like it's early on in the movie and you just sort of realize that this is a very talented person. And he's not just singing, he's dancing, and he's like dancing really well. And he's just like, I mean, I sort of enjoy that when an actor can like do more than act. It's kind of cool when they can like sing and dance. But again, like I'm not usually drawn to musical theater, but yeah.
It's almost like an older style of performing that seems more common a long time ago, and now when somebody like Hugh Jackman can do all those things, we're kind of like, wow, he's multi-talented or whatever.
Right.
Mironov does a little mini Louis Armstrong impression in the middle of that song as well, which is quite fun.
Oh yeah, also amazing.
It's yeah, like... it's like the fact that it's in Russian and I get that that's what he's doing is testament to this being a good impression.
Yeah, he's pretty, his performance is like really very amazing. And it's cool how then when Nakulin's character sings, he also like is able to sing even though he's like all fucked up. He doesn't dance or anything, but he sings really well. And that
well,
also
he does
sort of...
kind of dance, but
oh yeah, yeah,
in a very comical way.
And that just does sort of remind me of like another era of cinema or something when people had talents other than or yeah, I mean, I'm sort of romanticizing, and I just mean like,
well,
it was sort of funny that like both main characters are able to perform,
sort of all-round entertainers.
Right
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that comes from like still being closer to theater,
right? Though you don't necessarily have to say in dance and theater, but you just like maybe are sort of trained a little bit in it, at least moving physically.
And the way that it works, because you have to be seen from a stage rather than it being like massively blown up on a big screen, is it does lend itself more to the kind of the big gestures and whatever.
Right, right.
Actually, like in terms of the incidental music, I noticed that quite a lot of the music, especially early on, was quite almost like the sort of music that you hear over the top of like silent films, like the kind of quite plinky plonky piano type thing. So I kind of thought that was interesting in terms of, like, I don't know, maybe a conscious nod to those sorts of films. But, yeah.
Yeah, well, it plays well for scenes like the one where Mironov's character is, like, running around trapped in, like, the streets of Istanbul, like, trying to find where he's supposed to be getting out. I feel like that kind of stuff, which I don't, like, really know much about this era of film, but, like, has sort of a Charlie Chaplin-esque feel to it, which is this person just, like, running around. And they, I don't know what that, like, visual quality is, but it almost has a, almost, I don't, like, stop motion-y kind of thing happening, where it's, like, rapid in a specific way.
They do the same thing a few times in the movie. The other time I'm thinking of is when the two bad guys throw a rope and climb up to the veranda, remember, of Nicolin's apartment?
And, like, it's just that there's, like, fewer frames per second than we're used to. And so they're, like, moving really rapidly
right.
from one frame to the next, I guess.
But that is a way of, it's sped up. So it's, like, unnaturally sped up. Or I guess that's right. fewer frames. I didn't think about that. And, like...
Well, no, it's not that. It's just, like, now when we speed things up, it can be the same number of frames just played out faster, I guess. I don't know how that works.
But, yeah, there was a jerky quality to it, yeah.
Right. Which looks like jerky. Silent movies, definitely. I didn't think about that, but with the music paired with it, it definitely does. Yeah.
And I wonder if that's, like, intentional or, like... I mean, it has to be intentional to a certain extent, but I wonder, too, like, in 69, was that still just a common enough practice because the technology wasn't quite there, or was it, like, specifically used?
I feel like I'm more leaning towards it was specifically used because I feel like Soviet cinematography is, like, pretty developed or something, so...
Yeah, but I also wonder whether, like, back then... Because I think even in the West, there was more of a culture of we show not just the current stuff that is being churned out by the film industry. There was more of a, you know, we will also show stuff that's from like 10, 15, 20, whatever years ago on the big screen, just because we're not pumping out as many new films and also just like, you know, it's kind of something to do in a way that's really not the case anymore. So I wonder whether people were also just more familiar with older slapstick comedy than we are now. You know, you kind of have to be specifically into that now to have seen a lot of those.
Right.
I feel like now.
Yeah, like the people making movies in like the late 60s could have been more easily influenced and exposed to stuff that was coming out in like, I don't know, the 30s.
Maybe this is a stupid thing to base this my whole argument on, but I remember watching Asa, which is like from 1987 and is contemporary set, but during that we see some of the characters go to the cinema and they're watching a Chaplin film that's just being played at the cinema, which I don't know, I mean that those things still sometimes get cinema screenings even now in the West, but it's more like a special event rather than just, you know, I feel like going to the cinema. Oh, they're playing that Chaplin film again. It just doesn't happen. Because in the film, it's more like, we're just going to the cinema to see something that happens to be on, rather than, let's go and see the Chaplin film, because it's, you know, it's years since it's been on the big screen. I don't know.
That's a good point, because I think that also is, drawing attention to the fact that the audience of the movie at the time is more familiar, which I think is also what you were saying. Not just like the director is trying to wink at this, but it's just like more common kind of like visual medium. Yeah, you understand what I mean.
Yeah, and I think also, I may be just totally pulling this out of some random orifice, but I feel like in terms of the films that you could show in the Soviet Union that were from outside, I think slapstick stuff was a bit more like, okay, there's limited amount of like subversive potential for this, so we'll happily show it, rather than stuff that was a bit more contemporary from the West, which might be a bit more like fraught with problematic stuff. I don't know. That's funny.
It's also just more readable to like any audience because there's fewer words. you could watch a slapstick movie in a different language and like get a lot of the content.
I mean, I've listened to some podcast on film that it was talking about the introduction and like the period prior to the introduction of sound, and some like Hollywood bosses just being like, no, sound is dumb, that will like drastically reduce our market because we'll only be able to show it to people who understand English. This isn't worth the massive investment that it's going to cost to technologically make it work. So it kind of seems like a no-brainer that you would be really trying to go for that next technological advance. But a lot of studios were just like, well, it's really hard to do and we don't see why we'd want to do it anyway. But I realize that's a pretty massive tangent from the film we're actually supposed to be talking about, but
that's hilarious though. That's really funny. It's like, why would we want it to look more like real life? It's just like
yeah
like that's just not what film is.
No, it's fine the way it is and we can make more money this way anyway. But yeah, I don't know, maybe like more serious film scholars will disagree with my like butchering of the history possibly there, but never mind, you know. was there anything else just like randomly that we should have talked about that we haven't?
Well, I don't know. Maybe you guys can help me like expand on this theory. But when I was thinking about like the main things to talk about for this film, I thought about the imagining of the outside or like the West, which we've talked about. And the other thing I thought about, which we haven't talked about in detail, is the... We've referenced it, but we haven't talked about it as a phenomenon, which is the phenomenon of the, like, idiot or the fool or the bozo, or whatever we want to call it, in Russian culture, in, like, Russian everything, literature, film, folklore. Is that something that, like, I don't know, strikes you as true, Ali? Like, do you think that?
I mean, I know I'm not very familiar with Russian fairy tales, but I know there's a whole... big, massive, important character called Ivan Durak, which is like Ivan the Fool or Ivan the Idiot. Obviously, there's an important Dostoevsky novel also called The Idiot, literally Idiot. And I mean, part of the whole point of that novel, at least as far as I'm reading it, is that he actually isn't stupid. It's kind of just, you know, the realities make him seem naive. But yeah, I guess...
Well, my question is more like,
and then Holy Fools as well. That's another thing that they have.
Like, yeah, so
St. Basil, he was a holy fool. He has a whole cathedral that's like unofficially named after him. But yeah, so maybe it is a trope, but I'm just not enough of a specialist to know like why it's that way.
Well, okay, so my question is more, I can kind of explain a little bit. There are really like different types of fools in Russian language, and you've just sort of laid out most of them. And the holy fool is sort of the, maybe the one that the idiot is referencing the most explicitly. Dostoevsky's novel.
Yeah. Uroday, isn't it, is the
right
Russian word.
And but then there's just, I guess my question was just like this other fool character or the various types of fool characters. Okay, before I ask the question, I'll give some background. Basically, what I'm thinking of is, yeah, something like the folklore character, Ivan Durak, is like a really good example because he is pretty ancient and like really ubiquitous. And so his characteristics, for those who don't know, are being kind of lazy and sleeping a lot, but then also... being really kind, and he sort of represents heart over mind logic, and he also tends to be able to, he kind of like lives outside society in a way, and it tends to be able to fix problems with the help of magical friends.
Useful to have those.
And like actually like, so he has a sort of fool quality in that he, people like maybe think he's a fool because he doesn't do what other people are supposed to do, like work and get married and stuff.
He doesn't conform.
Yeah. And this like lazy aspect, but then yeah, at the sort of end of the day, he can accomplish things that others can't. And I was wondering if you had seen this sort of character. It's definitely not exactly one-to-one mapped onto Ivan the Fool, but it can be different kinds of like sort of innocent, dumb main male characters generally. Is that something that you had seen a lot in other films that you talked about?
I mean part of why I'm doing the podcast is to watch more films, so I haven't seen a ton, but Shurik is, you know, again, same director, is pretty, I mean, he's very bright in terms of being able to invent things and being very intellectual, but he's also severely lacking in common sense. So it's a bit of a contrast with Nikulin's character, because I mean, I think his job title is economist, so presumably he isn't as dumb as in his job as it seems, but you don't really get very much indication other than that his job that he is quite smart, whereas Shurik, you get the impression he is quite clever, just ill-equipped to dealing with like normal everyday reality in some ways. But yeah, I feel like I don't quite know Russian film well enough to say whether this is something specific to this director or whether it's something that all, you know, comes up again and again, I guess.
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, I don't have a fully developed theory either because I haven't also seen enough film, but it reminded me of, I just recently watched another movie from the 70s called, it was from 73, so fairly close period of time, called Dacha. And have you seen that?
No, I haven't even heard of it, so. I'll add it to the list.
Okay. Yeah, it's like, it's, I was watching it because we were doing an episode on the Dacha.
Sure.
And I was like looking for Dacha in pop culture. But yeah, it has this main male character or there's two main characters, the husband and wife, and the male one is like, he reminds me, he has sort of similar vibes to Nicolin's character in the sense that he is a sweet, like, good husband. He, like, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't have any vices, which is, like, such a, like, Russian trope also, like, the good man.
Well, except he does kind of drink quite a lot.
Well, he does, but he's, like, it's not the real him.
He's not a hard drinker in the sense of, like, he goes out of the way to be wasted all the time. It's more like he's just not very good at saying no.
Right, and normally that has worked for him. We get the sense that he normally doesn't drink. And, like, this character in the Dacha also sort of, like, normally is everything's good, but then he, like, fucks up pretty early on in the movie by, like, just, like, stupidly losing all this money that they've saved up. And that's sort of the setup for the film. And they've saved it up to buy a Dacha. And it's just sort of then, like, his also recovering from this big mistake that he made. But it really is a similar character in the sense of, like, you have this ideal kind of those characters are definitely supposed to be like good citizens in a lot of ways because they, like, Nikulin's character is a family man and he really doesn't have, like, I don't know, he doesn't sort of stand out in any way, but that's a good thing. Like,
yeah, and as soon as the whole arm thing happens, he goes to, like, the ship captain and is like, somebody put these jewels on my arm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's kind of like...
He's a good Soviet.
He's like a kind of painfully innocent also in that sense, which is like, yeah, which is...
Yeah. So,
which you get the sense that that's a good thing, but in that movie and in also in the Dacha movie, like, it's sort of like that helps it be satirical because it's kind of like showing how dumb that looks or something.
Yeah.
Right, if you take those things to, like, their actual logical conclusion.
And how people will, like, take advantage of that, or... Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of a couple of other examples, the more we're talking about it. Like, the Pierre character in War and Peace, again, is a very smart guy, but he also seems, like, fairly clueless in real life. Like, there's the whole sequence, I just watched it this last week, of his wandering around the Battle of Borodino, you know, where all this, like, you know, war and mayhem is happening, and he's just being kind of useless and getting in everyone's way, and it's kind of like, how did you end up here, and, you know, you're not really helping, and you're quite a nice, kind person, but you're not very practical. And actually, going back to Asar again, like, Bananan, very talented, very smart, but also just, like, not that savvy and quite idealistic to his, well, detriment. I don't want to give too much away for those who haven't seen Asar yet. So, yeah. Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something as far as it being kind of tropey.
Yeah, and like, I don't... I don't know... I don't have, like, a sort of developed theory on that, but I mean, in that particular case of the diamond arm, despite all of this dopiness, that's sort of like the point is that in the end, this character, you know, yeah, despite his lack of maybe like street smarts or like common sense sometimes, he ends up winning. Like
he muddles through.
Yeah, he ends up, I mean, that is definitely a spoiler, but he ends up sort of like.
Yes.
Really getting the.
Or does he? I don't know. I unspoiled it. Maybe. I don't think that worked, but never mind.
Depends on how you look at it.
Yeah, it's like Inception, really. No. Sorry, Lily, I shamelessly interrupted again.
No, it's okay. Just like, that's the conclusion of that. So if you're looking for sort of a symbolic reading or something, he does sort of have that, like, lucky fool thing that Ivan, that character from folklore has.
But yeah, like with the Dostoevsky idiot example and Bananan, that's not always the way those stories go. But this is one where, like, Russian listeners, I'd love to know what you think about that idea. Are we, like, completely off the wall and wrong there, or is it really a thing? So yeah, write in and let us know. Awesome. So I think we've probably talked about this film for longer than the actual film lasts, so that sometimes happens, and that's fine. I think I wanted to start with Smith here. Is this a film that you would recommend to people and people in general, or like just people who have an interest in like Russian culture, like, or would you not recommend it at all? Sorry, that was a really poorly phrased question, but yeah.
Generally, yes, I would recommend it. I enjoyed it enough to recommend it. I think that it would take a specific person to enjoy it, probably. Like, I wouldn't, like, casually recommend The Diamond Arm to somebody if they're like, I want to watch a movie, you know? But
have I got a choice for you?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely think, like, I think that it's definitely a worthwhile movie to watch.
Awesome. And is that an agreement of the collective leadership, or is that just Smith going out on a limb there, Lily?
No, I agree. I think it was recommended to me as a very good representation of like a Soviet movie, and I think I would recommend it in that context for like a particular type of humor and a particular example of like a bunch of really important Soviet actors. So if it was like somebody interested in Soviet film, I'd be like, oh yeah, this is something you have to watch, definitely.
Yeah, this is kind of like Soviet comedy of, you know, late 60s, early 70s, kind of at the top of its game. And like you say, it's kind of like all the stars in one place and you know, doing their thing.
Yeah, and Russians, I mean, it's important also for people interested in Russian culture, because like a lot of classic or cult Soviet movies, Russians like refer to it, and to these movies they quote, it's just like a present part of contemporary culture. So that's also a cool tidbit.
Well, and humor is not necessarily something that's foremost in Western stereotypes about the Russians as well. So it is important to remind people or bring it to their awareness that, you know, Russians, like everyone, have a sense of humor, and that it's, you know, although this is quite slapstick, there's more going on under the surface. So
Russian humor is, that's a really good point, that it's maybe underappreciated in the West, which is just people's ignorance, because Russian humor is like really, again, developed. I don't know why I'm using this word. I can't think of another word. I'm like thinking of it kind of in Russian, but it's like, it's important. It's like really important part of everything from everyday culture to production of culture, as it's said in Russian history, which just means like, you know, movies, art, whatever.
Yeah, it's something that they pride themselves on, but we don't necessarily know. I say we in the general, like the average Westerner is not really thought about it that much. It's not like, oh, those Russians, they're hilarious.
Who is the I'm just blanking right now, who is the president who has made a lot of jokes about?
Probably Reagan.
No. Reagan. Oh, was it Reagan telling Soviet jokes?
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, so somebody appreciated. But there's
somebody appreciated making jokes.
There was a TV show, and I don't know, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like something that Nikulin was on, or at least I saw an episode with him, that was just like a bunch of comics get together and have like are having a dinner and like drinking, and they just take turns telling what Russians call anecdotes, which are like funny stories.
Yeah, that's one of those, like, it's a real false friend in terms of translation.
Yeah, anecdote, yeah. But I just watched some of with Nikulin in it, like a little part of one of that show, like one of the episodes, when he's old and he's just like amazing. He just tells anecdote after anecdote. But he's sort of like the legend, the star of all comics. So he's especially good. But yeah, it's important.
Yeah, so check it out. Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it. And yeah, people should totally check out She's in Russia, or Sir. So thank you, Sir.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, where can we find you on Tinternet?
Twitter and Telegram at She's in Russia. And then we also have a website at shesinrussia.com. And then you can listen to the podcasts on any platform that you listen to podcasts on.
Superb. Yay. Okay, well, thanks very much again. And yeah, thank you all for listening. До свидания, folks.
До свидания.
Весь покрытый зеленью, абсолютно весь остров не везде. Hello again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Roost Files Unite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. There's a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a Roost Files Unite Facebook group you can join. We're on Twitter at RoostFilesU. And you can also email at roostfilesunite@gmail.com. If you can spare a couple of minutes to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, that will help other people hear about the show and would be very much appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and goodbye. Крокодил не ловится, не растет кокос, плачут Богу молятся, не жалея слез, плачут Богу молятся, не жалея слез. Крокодил не ловится, не растет кокос. Вроде не бездельники и могли бы жить. Им бы понедельники взять и отменить, им бы понедельники взять и отменить. Вроде не бездельники и могли бы жить. Как назло на острове нет календаря, ребятня и взрослые пропадают зря. Ребятня и взрослые пропадают зря. На проклятом острове нет календаря.